Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit.
Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast all about, Brexit. As always, we are here in the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce, and I'm joined by Christian Spence. How are you, Christian?
I am well. Yes, it's just me this week.
Yep. Alex Davis is where exactly?
He is somewhere on a boat in the Ionian Sea, so he's taking a well-deserved break this week.
Very Alex Davis.
Absolutely.
We've got plenty to talk about this week, mostly the Florence speech, but before we get into that, thank you for joining in on the conversation. On Twitter, I'm at J Beardmore. Where are you, Christian?
You can find me at GMCC_Christian.
And please do leave those iTunes reviews. They are very helpful. Because of those reviews, we've been listened to by more people than ever before last week, which is always encouraging. Okay, let's start with the Florence speech. What were your main takeaways from this?
My main takeaway really actually was one of unsurprised disappointment, I guess. We talked last week, of course, we were just a couple of days before the speech when we did the last podcast, that really she needed to give the speech of her life, because, and that's really driven by the fact Michel Barnier, who of course is the lead negotiator for the European Union and all this, gave a speech to the Italian Parliament. I think the day we recorded, or round about. And he was expressing his frustration, essentially. Mm. There was a timeline agreed to by us. Now, of course, if you remember, when the European Union set out its desired negotiating timeline, it said we want three things dealt with first: the preliminary stuff, the citizens' rights, the divorce bill, the settlement, as it's been called, and the Northern Ireland border, and we're not moving on to trade until future relationship, until we've got those three sorted out. Mm-hmm. Cast our minds back again to around then, and we had David Davis, Secretary of State for exiting the European Union and the UK government, say he was going to have the row of a lifetime over summer, because he said those two things have to happen together, discussing future relationship and those three things, and then capitulated. So we are where we are. So it was all a case of we have to sort these things out first. And Barnier's speech before Theresa May spoke in Florence really re-emphasised all of this. We've yet to see significant movement. We've yet to see on those papers where the UK has given some kind of evidence really into it, there still aren't actual positions. So yeah. We talked several podcasts ago about the Northern Ireland border paper and the customs paper. They came out together from the UK. Neither of them actually set out positions. They set out options. And essentially what the EU is saying is, this is not what we want. We need to know what you want, what your desired solution is to this, and then we will debate. But to present us with a list doesn't actually help move things forward. So he'd set all this out. He'd set out some realities as well. It's a good phrase, actually, and we've seen a few of the other commentators kind of pick up on this in the last week, reminding us that the UK has chosen to become a third country to the EU. Mm-hmm. That is its sovereign right and decision, and the EU respects it. Now, that kind of sounds obvious, but I think it's a useful reminder of the relationships between the UK and the EU. Because we're portraying the UK media that the EU's being, it's being slow, it's dragging its heels, it's not doing what we want. The EU is treating this, as you might expect, really, for a large, you know, large-scale bureaucracy, very legalistically.
Yeah.
You have chosen to leave. How are you going to go about that? And it wants us to spell that out. So he was very clear about all that. Deals in the future will only happen and we'll only discuss once we've got the first three things sorted out. We're not there yet. We're making good progress on civil rights, on citizens' rights.
Yep.
But we clearly have no solution to those other two things. So there was a lot of pressure on May to give a good speech which pushed back at this. Now, for me, it didn't.
No.
For me, it didn't do what it needed to do. But I guess there was a bit of an admission of reality in there. So, first of all, I guess we got a nice A-level essay on the benefits of the European Union, and I think, you know, some of the commentators live tweeting said about 15 minutes in, this was basically, she'd spelled out all the reasons why we should stay, all the benefits the EU can provide, but then moved on to, of course, this deep and special relationship, but also I think the big one is the tacit acknowledgement of a transition period. Now, we've always, Theresa May's always talked about this, the government's talked about it, but has never really spelt it out in black and white. The Lancaster House speech from back in January refers to a transition arrangement, but not in any detail. This time we now know what government is looking for is a two-year transition period after our leaving the European Union in March 2019, but during which she now expects that all of the EU acquis, so the law, the entire law of the EU, will continue to apply during that process.
Yes.
Now, from a technical and legal point of view, that's not a surprise. If there was, you know, from the sheer practicalities, that was the way it was going to work. Of course, for the hard Brexiters in the Conservative Party and across the population, that's got some hard messages, because that means continued payment into budgets at the rate we are paying now, and it means continued freedom of movement. But it does mean, of course, the idea is we maintain full access to full participation in the single market, and we are in a form of customs union, if not the customs union for that period.
Hmm. So I guess the next point would be, if Theresa May has not added any more detail onto the Brexit negotiations, and I don't believe that she has, what was the point? Was it just to soothe some nerves?
I think so. And again, lots of commentators sort of said this, you know, okay, the speech helped in a way in that it was a slight softening of tone, or at least a softening to accepting some of the realities we've talked about here for, you know, for many weeks now. But who was the audience? The European Commission, the head of the heads of state were invited, but none turned up. The room was essentially packed full of UK journalists.
And what message do you think the EU was sending by not sending the heads of state and their senior people?
I think for me it's a case of, look, there is a negotiation structure in place.
There is a process.
Yeah, that's it. This isn't part of it. So really, it was a speech for her cabinet, probably, as much as anything else. Of course, there'd been a very long cabinet meeting the day before that speech, 2.5 hours, one of the longest cabinet meetings ever, where no doubt Boris Johnson, Philip Hammond and David Davis all argued their points in that. But really, it was a speech for them and probably for the British press as much as it was to the EU.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? Because the cabinet meeting, it feels to me as if the ground has now changed. Hard Brexiteers want to get out, you know, not within 2 years, but as close to the 2 years as possible. And even the moderates now kind of just accepted, well, it's going to be two years or 4 years. That to me seems like the moderate version of Brexit.
I think so. I think at kind of that high level, I think you're right. There's an acknowledgement that this, frankly, we are not going to be ready with all the will in the world, and with, you know, if you triple the size of the civil service, we are not going to be ready to be out in March 2019. We are going to need some kind of continuation agreement. I think one of the challenges that might well emerge over the coming weeks, and I'm surprised the press didn't pick up on this much, there were only some of those commentators we talked about who we really like. David Alan Green, particularly FT, talked about this in one of his blogs. But of course, what she's asking for is a full continuation of the EU acquis, so single market participation, customs union, freedom of movement, payments into the budget, everything it is now, for 2 years after we leave the European Union in 2019. So she's not saying that we delay leaving. We're still leaving, and it, of course, it is a, as I always say, it's a matter of law now that we leave in March 2019. But essentially what that means is we'll remain within the EU, within the EU structures for 2 years, but with no MEPs, with no head of state or equivalent at the European Council. We have become worse than Norway. We've genuinely become a rule taker without any influence on it, which seems like a slightly odd position, because, you know, we've argued long and hard here for EEA-EFTA and the Norway kind of model, and people said you can't go for that, and actually government has explicitly ruled it out, saying it's no good, we'd be a rule taker. But of course we know that's not true for all the reasons we've talked about here before. But actually it now appears government position is to the government mandate now is to take us into a position that is essentially worse than Norway. All of the rules, none of the same.
And for what reason?
I think it's about this continuity. The whole challenge here for the UK government, as it's kind of been working its path through transition and the exit stuff, has been it's up against a hard line that essentially I don't think the Conservative Party could sell it to its backbenchers or half of its cabinet if they said what we actually want to do is stay in the European Union for another 2 years and set a transition point out after that while we essentially we work out what it is we want. But essentially that's kind of what we're asking for. So we have to go to kind of meet the democratic mandate and the will of the people, whatever that might be, but we keep everything in place for an additional 2 years.
Now, just sticking with domestic politics, and in particular the Tory party, so much keeps on coming up is this cabinet split. Just from what you've said, and, you know, as I alluded to before, you've got a difference between 2 years and 4 years. And how severe is this? How severe is this split, and how will it affect the Brexit process?
I think it's pretty severe just from the sheer divergence of views we're hearing. So, you know, we're now...
It's a difference of 24 months, so.
Yeah, that's it. Well, we're 15 months or so since the referendum decision, the change of government, and Theresa May coming into power and the new departments being formed. Essentially, we're still no closer for Cabinet having a single position. Now, we talked about this a little bit last week. This is kind of politically unheard of and legalistically very difficult because we operate a cabinet government system in the UK. Cabinet must sign off major decisions, but actually clearly there isn't a united view. Now, I think they're probably doing better. The Tory party is probably doing better in the last few months at keeping the worst of those arguments off the front pages, despite, you know, Boris's big 4,000-word epic in The Telegraph last week. They're kind of managing to downplay it, but I still think there are big issues, and I think there are big issues in those two positions. This, let's just get out, we don't owe Europe a penny, we can trade under WTO rules. Again, we've explored before why we are the challenges involved in all of that. To this, we need a transitional period, we need a softer one. Should we actually be trying to stay in the single market anyway and not leave it? Are we looking to just leave the EU or leave everything to do with it? It's not really clear how that's going to hold as the Tory party comes under more and more pressure. We're recording this now just after Jeremy Corbyn has given apparently a 50 or 55 minute speech at Labour Party conference. That's been the best attended Labour Party conference in a long time. All of the delegates and certainly the momentum side of the party is delighted that everything's sort of looking better. This isn't the podcast to talk about the policies that are being proposed, but there are some interesting ones in there. There's all that. So Labour are looking happier, despite the fact that actually their own position on Brexit is absolutely a split as the Tories is.
I mean, not to delve into too much of Labour policy, but how do they reconcile staying in the free market, which is apparently their stated position now, with some rather odd views regarding, you know, industrial strategy, say?
It is odd. And again, I think this is where... This is where the whole concept of Brexit is opening up sort of channels and grooves, and I'm using horrible metaphors here, in policy making that no one's ever had to handle before.
Yeah.
Mostly because we see it not only from some of the statements of Jeremy Corbyn recently about the problem, you know, the problem is he thinks he wouldn't be able to implement a lot of the policies he'd like to implement while we're a member of the EU, because that stops it. So from the industrial strategy point of view, it's really about financial support to companies or sectors, which EU rules prohibit under, I forgot the proper phrase for it at the moment.
It's certainly competition law.
It's essentially competition law. And he wouldn't be able to nationalise all the industries he wants to nationalise under EU law. None of that's really true. EU law doesn't really care about public or private. It cares about monopolies and competition.
Right.
So, of course, actually, you know, most of the energy, water, rail, transportation systems across most of Europe are nationalised.
So
there's no issue with any of that.
So to simplify that, would it be correct to say something like, you can have an EDF or someone, providing it plays by the rules against a private provider of energy, or however it may go?
That's exactly it. It's about competition rather than ownership. So the usual one that comes to mind is rail franchising. That's the one that often sort of comes into people's heads. You can't renationalise the railways because competition or privatisation franchises. Well, of course, actually, lots of, across Europe, lots of the railway franchises are run by nationally owned companies.
Mm.
But they do it on competitive tender.
Yes.
So it's fine. So actually, if you go, you know, I was in Italy most recently there, you have one franchise for the high-speed network, one franchise for the regional network, one franchise for the local. They all happen to be state-owned, but they're all separate. They can't be subsidised directly by the state. There are, you know, they have to play. There are subsidy rules in the same way ours happens.
Yeah.
Ours are subsidised, but essentially the actual commercial competition bit is an open playing field. That's what matters to the EU, not whether it's public or private.
Well, it would be very interesting when the Labour Party comes in, a bit more scrutiny as to exactly how they model these industrial strategies with membership of the EU. But just sticking with subsidies, I think this is quite a nice way to channel into it. There has been a story in the press this week between Bombardier and Boeing, and I thought it was quite interesting because I know it's not Brexit related, but there are some interesting business aspects here which maybe people can relate to via Brexit.
Yeah, well, the thing is, of course, these days, because of, you know, we've talked in lots of podcasts before about the way trade has evolved and what the WTO does now and global cooperation. On the whole, trade just doesn't hit the news anymore.
Yeah,
you know, if you cast, you know, I guess you're probably old enough too, cast our minds back to the 90s, you concepts of trade wars, of competitive tariffing, of kind of block stuff coming into markets from overseas.
I seem to remember we got into a little bit of a tussle in America over Kashmir. That's the last one that I remember.
Yeah, there was that, and then of course there was steel dumping from China actually a couple of years ago.
That's
probably a more recent one. But these things rarely hit the press. And of course, we've got this big one that's just hit. So we have we've three big players in all of this, I guess. We've got the Canadian company Bombardier. I guess most Brits probably don't know Bombardier as an aircraft manufacturer.
No, I think it's trains.
If they know them anything, it's trains. Mm. So they've got a couple of manufacturing plants over here in the UK. But they've got an aircraft plant in Northern Ireland. There is, of course, the mighty American giant Boeing, one of the world's two primary aircraft manufacturers. And those are the two corporate players, and you've the three countries behind them, the US, the UK for Northern Ireland, and Canada. And what's happened here essentially is the US has raised a dispute saying that the only reason Bombardier has been able to sell some of the jets it's currently making at below cost price into the US market because of subsidies from the UK and Canada.
Yes.
Because of government UK subsidies to the manufacturing here in Northern Ireland, because Canadian subsidies to the home firm back in Canada, they've been able essentially to go in below cost. Now, of course, this is precisely what tariffs are designed to try and handle. The whole concept is, if you're going to start subsidising a company in country A, which can sell its goods into company B, and artificially compete with company B's companies who do that, country B's, sorry, companies who do that kind of thing, then you get an unfair advantage.
Yes.
So what we'll do is we'll slap a tariff on the goods coming into the UK to try and level the playing field. Often it's not about leveling the playing field. Often it's about actually tipping the balance
in
favour of the home market. All countries do it. The WTO kind of regulates all this stuff. So essentially, the US has said, we think because of government subsidies, you are able to undercut us. Therefore, it's not a fair market anymore. Therefore, we get the right to impose full aerospace tariffs onto those goods coming in, which for the US it would be 219%.
Eye-watering.
Yeah, so essentially tripling.
So
the cost.
The surprise here wasn't so much that they contravened tariff laws; it was the harshness of the penalty. So presumably they think that there's been subsidy up to 220%. Of the aircraft price?
That I don't know. I've not read the whole trade dispute that's just been raised. Now, the big concern here, of course, is essentially this jeopardises Bombardier jobs in the UK.
Yes,
that's,
it does.
That's the issue that's been raised from the UK. Because if you're going to put them in at that price, they can't sell them. Those jets are now commercially inviable in the US market. Those sales aren't going to happen. The manufacturing plant shuts down. 4,500 jobs, I think, in Belfast are at risk. Now, of course, what's been interesting, I think, from the Brexit side now, is if we make those parallels, has been watching people's reaction to it.
Mm.
So, first of all, we've had people say, well, this is outrageous. We just levy the same tariffs back. But, of course, the UK is a member of the European Union's common commercial policy. So the UK doesn't have the power to levy tariffs. All tariffs inbound into the UK are subject to the European Union's common external tariff, which you talked about before. That's its, that's the way it regulates products, the price of products, essentially coming into the EU market. So the UK can do nothing on its own.
Okay. So, whilst we're still a member of the EU, what do the EU intend to do about it?
We've not heard anything yet. As we're speaking now, I've not seen any comments from the EU at all. Apparently, she certainly raised some concerns over the phone. Being Theresa May, our Prime Minister, but I've not seen anything as yet.
So, what would Bombardier do from here then? And does the Brexit process in any way help Bombardier?
No, I think probably for, at least for the short term, it makes it much more complex. Because the truth is now, I think, you know, before the referendum vote, this is exactly the kind of thing where the EU would have the UK would have gone to the EU saying, look, we think we may have a trade dispute. How do we start to unravel all that? Trade disputes are normally taken to the WTO. So EU and US go to the WTO and they try and hack out what all the issues are. That may be the EU does have a right, if they think they're in dispute over trade law, then you are allowed to place retaliatory tariffs. You can put temporary retaliatory, complex word for Wednesday, tariffs onto those goods. Now, of course, the point is, from the EU's point of view, why would it want to start doing this to specifically help out a member state that's leaving? You know, they don't want to start upsetting the apple cart. There are some big discussions that have yet to be had for both the EU and the UK, and actually all other countries, as the UK leaves the European Union, about what happens to the tariff rates and about what happens to the quota rates. Because essentially you're taking the second biggest economy of the EU out. So all of those deals that were done before on the basis that the UK was part of that bloc and isn't going to be, will be ripe for the countries really starting to say, well, actually, we want to extricate a bit of leverage now.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because a lot of these deals would have been made on the assumption that they do have access to the UK market, which is fairly sizable in its own right.
It is, absolutely. And I think this is the challenge. You know, I think we talked about, again, in a podcast or two or three ago, about the challenge now. The UK government's kind of goal in all this at the minute is we just want to roll over all of the third country trade agreements that we have as a membership of the EU with all of those other countries, and they won't, and you just take them as they are and go. That's a theoretical and legalistic kind of reasonableness, but actually you need the other country's consent to do that. And it's not clear why. You know, I think we talked about we've done all sorts of stuff, haven't we, on lemons from South Africa.
Yeah, we've done spotty lemons. Yeah, we've done chlorinated chicken,
lamb from New Zealand. You know, all of these things, these countries are going to say, well, actually, we've got a bit of leverage because this deal was done on the basis of a block of 300 million people and 27 countries. We're now going to a block of 240 million, one block of 60. There are different deals to be struck here. And also, the UK is going to be at a very weak disadvantage. It's going to be at a big disadvantage in these talks because we need these things sorting fast.
Well, I mean, if you want to, if you want to get one over on the UK trade-wise, probably best do it now.
Yeah, you've got a huge window of opportunity where all of the partners in the negotiation know we need this to happen fast, and that doesn't put us in a strong negotiating position.
Well, just to move on from the Bombardier Boeing thing, and to put a bit more colour on it, because it's actually a really complex story. Apparently, the C-Series, which is the aircraft which they're putting the tariffs on, Boeing has no equivalents. But the reason that they want to do it is not so much to warn off Bombardier, because they don't compete with them, it's to warn off national manufacturers from India and China who will be coming into Boeing's markets and making things which will compete with them.
Yeah, and this again actually is an important point as we talk about, you know, the EU and the UK renegotiating trade agreements. Is you've always got to have in mind how the WTO operates, and it's all about leveling the playing field globally as much as possible. And you've got to be very careful in lots of legal issues about setting precedent. So, yes, even though in this case Bombardier is not the challenger, the problem is if you allow a third country to start to come in with undercuts and you don't challenge it, essentially, if China does it in 2 years' time, they will be able to say, well, you've already made an exception.
Yes.
Bombardier in the UK did this 2 years ago. You didn't have a problem with that. Why do you have a problem
and
with
that? And now they've got a direct competitor.
Yeah.
One last question on this. What actually does count as a subsidy? Is it building them a factory? Is it giving them preferential tax rates? What counts?
It's any and all of those things, essentially. So it's anything which simply gives you a competitive commercial advantage. And this is the this is the stuff we're talking about with Jeremy Corbyn earlier. Yeah. Can he get his industrial strategy through? So the EU operates the concept of state aid. There we are. That's the phrase I couldn't remember earlier. State aid rules. So companies can only receive a certain amount of money from any government in any 3 year period, essentially to try and level the playing field across the single market. So there are rules by which you can intervene and which you can support, but they're capped. Now we've had sort of the Corbyn saying, well, outside of all that, I'd want to do much more. Yeah, okay, fine. You might even be outside. It's hard to see it in the short term because we're going to have to maintain some form of continuity with the EU. But in the long term, we'd want to intervene much more. The huge challenge is the WTO will have something to say about that.
Yeah.
Because of course the problem is subsidising industries essentially is a commercial advantage. So in most trade deals, there will be rules set out about commercial competition. Because otherwise, how does a trade deal work?
Yeah.
So imagine, we're 6 days now into the CETA agreement, the European Union-Canadian agreement coming into effect. We can use that as an example. We now have free trade in a number of, complete tariff-free trade in a number of production and manufacturing areas between those two nations. How does that work in terms of open competition if Canada, well, let's use Canada as an example.
Yes.
If Canada bungs a load of money to Bombardier, so it no longer has to make the profit margins that a European one has to work with. Essentially, that immediately contradicts the trade deal. So the trade deal explicitly forbids certain levels of commercial support.
See, I would say the only winner here, actually, is the American consumer who gets cheaper aeroplanes.
Well, I mean, this goes to the heart of what tariffs are about. There's a very open and liberal concept of economic theory would always say the only person that matters in any of this is the consumer.
Yeah,
Who buys is the only person who matters. Now, of course, in reality, there are wider things to think about because we talked about this. If you open UK economy fully to the globe, if we go with that Economist for Free Trade paper and say no tariffs on anything, actually that's really good news for our consumers because they would be able to get much cheaper things. But you would also see complete devastation across a number of industries where the UK could not compete with emerging markets. Depending on your own point of view and all the rest of it, you'll think that's good, bad, indifferent to all the rest of it. But it does have huge challenges for local economies. Sort of the huge challenge. So if you were to say, we want to do more to support free trade with sub-Saharan Africa, developing countries, we want to use their agriculture much more rather than our own, let's kill all the tariffs. Great, you and I will get much cheaper coffee and much cheaper etc. But actually you will just kill a swathe. You won't do the coffee because we don't produce it. Yeah? That's not a great example. But for those where they could compete on wheat, then you would just kill that production in the UK. That potentially has medium, long-term effects on local economies, on those farming industries. What happens to, how do you support rural economies if you kill agriculture? It's all great. The best example really is kind of around the 80s and the big change in industrial towns in the north.
Yes.
You can make the perfect case that why should the UK consumer pay, I'm making up numbers, £50 a tonne for coal from the north of England when you can get it at £30 a tonne from Poland or Russia or anywhere else? Absolutely. But if you take all the jobs of the people in those towns away, you now have an additional cost. Now, of course, what you should weigh up is, what's the difference in cost? Should we support the economies locally? Should we allow consumers to get the benefit? You get some very complex, not only economic, but political trade-offs.
Yes, which I think we're still feeling now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as long as you've not heard of any tariffs on podcasts, I think I'm fairly comfortable with a tariff-free economy. Let's just bring the focus back to Europe a second. Theresa May made her speech, but of course there is another side to this, which is the European Council. And Donald Tusk has given his gut reaction. Just run us through the process of what Tusk has said and how this will relate to the European Council meeting, which I think is it end of the week?
It's end of the month. European Council's end of October, so we're a month away from the Council meeting. So essentially, both Michel Barnier, the Brexit negotiator of the EU, and Donald Tusk, President of the European Council, have warmly welcomed the intentions of the Theresa May speech, but both have said we're still short on detail. So they've said they're glad to see a recognition that there needs to be an extended transition. They're glad to see that there's an acknowledgement that any transition period will include full oversight of all EU jurisdictions,
including the ECJ.
Everything, because that is the only body that is legally allowed to essentially, from their point of view, to oversee European law. But we still don't have enough detail. So what does this transition period look like? Exactly how do you expect it to function? What changes to law are required? That kind of level of detail is still missing from the EU's point of view. The other one, of course, is, I think the interesting one, is they've reasserted the negotiating stance of the EU. So don't forget, there are three sets of negotiating objectives that we've seen. There is that from the European Council, so the 27... heads of state or heads of government of the other EU nations. The European Parliament has also put out its own objectives, and then there are actually the unified objectives which Michel Barnier has got to work within. Now, what they've reaffirmed is, first of all, thank you for your speech, Mrs. May. We now look forward to seeing how, in the negotiations, your government starts to outline the practicalities of all that. Secondly, Michel Barnier noted that he does not have, within his negotiating remit, the power to agree to a transition period.
Ah.
So that's never been suggested, because, of course, the EU has been focused, utterly focused, on first objectives first.
Yep.
We need to get the divorce sorted out, then we talk out later. And he also reaffirmed in saying that first of all, we'll need to go back to the European Council to get revised negotiating guidelines. And those will be drawn up once the European Union has decided whether a transition period is in its interest. So there's that sort of firm pushback saying, that's fine, everything you've said is great, and this kind of points to something we've always had problems with about the government approach, and actually, you know, all of our political parties' approach, is they all talk about it as if they can deliver the outcome on their own.
Yeah.
Not that this is actually a negotiation between two sides. So, great, you have now asked for a negotiating period, draw up the papers which tell us what that looks like, and we will then consider whether it is in our interest to even start opening conversations about what that looks like.
Yeah.
So, that's a big, firm pushback. Now, that is not... You know, lots of the press have grabbed this week and gone, this is outrageous, they're firming up and all the rest of it. It's like, no. This is all spelt out in black and white in negotiating guidelines the EU published earlier this year. So there's nothing new here. It was referenced in Donald Tusk's speech the day after the referendum, 15 months ago. It was referenced in another speech he gave around Christmas this year. It's in all the formal documents. So we've known the EU would always take this approach, which is one of the reasons, really, why we've been so disappointed with government reaction. Or, you know, on its positioning all the way through. It's like it's almost like you're ignoring there's another side. And you don't know what they think, when actually they've laid out very, very clearly. So essentially, really, the ball is now back in the UK's court. I guess the other thing to have said, of course, is he said at this stage we have not made sufficient progress to move to the second part of the negotiation.
Which is quite worrying, because this is where we wanted the parallel. So we actually thought there was a bit of ground given here. Turns out there was none. Not yet.
And I think, and what the EU is saying, this is not because we're not willing, but we agreed between us, between the UK and the EU, what the order of these negotiations would be. We've still not completed the first half yet.
Well, on previous podcasts, we have bemoaned the lack of knowledge in the UK about the political processes in other countries. So, here is your chance to shine. Just tell me, do you think that the German election results are going to make any difference whatsoever to the Brexit process? I suspect you're going to say no. But do you think it's going to change Germany's attitude towards Europe?
My gut reaction is as you're right, it's a firm no to the first one. And I think actually if you travel around Europe, I spent a bit of time out there this year, and I'm reading foreign newspapers more and more, is I think what will be a surprise for most UK people is to realise that it is extremely hard to find a Brexit story. in any of the European newspapers or any of the European channels. It is not on the radar. It is seen as an ancillary issue, essentially. It's something that's happening. Most of them don't want it. France is the only country that actually has a majority that will be delighted to see the UK go. But it's not registering. So in that sense, I think the election result... I mean, first of all, we've not seen a change of Chancellor. Yep. Angela Merkel has been returned for the fourth term. So I don't think there's anything there. Now, where we did see a change in the German election results is a big rise in the share of the vote for Alternative für Deutschland, which is a right-wing party. It's you can't call them similar to UKIP because their political objectives are different.
Yes.
But if you see them as to the right of our Conservative Party, some people would describe them as Nazis, some would describe them as far-right. Right-wing, undoubtedly. The rise in the AfD has really been caused specifically by Angela Merkel's response to the European migrant crisis and the large numbers of migrants that have come into Germany since then, and they're pushing back for a different approach.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting, I think, with AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, is the parallels you've seen in both the UK. In the general election, in the referendum result, and in the general election result, in the presidential election result, I beg your pardon, in the States, is we see a few common things. We see that it is in those areas where there is the least immigration that we see the strongest votes against immigration.
It is always fascinating.
Yeah, and we see that in the UK overall. You know, the cities which have got the utterly the lion's share of immigration all voted for Remain. The seaside towns where there is basically no immigration got huge, strong Leave votes. We saw the same in the United States. The East and West Coasts, Midwest, the liberal side of America, all with big immigrant populations, all voting Remain. Rust Belt states in the Deep South, few immigrants, all voting Trump. On that side, so you see that pattern in Germany. We see that it's the old East Germany, which is where the largest share of the vote was driven. So that bit of Germany, which is still economically lagging. Germany's spent hundreds of billions of euros since reunification in trying to level those economies up, but they're still a long way from doing that. So you do see all those parallels. And the other one, I guess, which is a great parallel to the UK, is the vote share, that increased vote share for AfD, that right-wing party, has come broadly equally from the centre-right and from the hard left.
Oh, really?
So again, so you see this challenge, you see that sort of thing that actually, the UKIP vote was driven primarily from two places: disenfranchised anti-European conservatives, older voters on the whole, and from the harder left of the Labour Party. That's where the Leave vote primarily came from in the UK.
Well, I mean, you might say, wouldn't you, the Leave vote in the UK, there's not so much the hard left, but the neglected left.
That's a good point. Yeah, and so it is. You've got this thing that you've got a right wing party that is drawing support from opposite sides of the spectrum.
Mm.
Now, of course, that causes huge political challenges, as we see that writ large here in the UK. You've got a Labour Party that's notionally at the moment supporting Brexit, albeit slightly softer, with a parliamentary party that's overwhelmingly in form of Remain, a voter base that's overwhelmingly in favour of Remain. But a chunk of the party that supports Leave, and a chunk of its core working class vote, if you like, that traditional disenfranchised bit that's Leave supporting, but is also drawing its power from the right of the Conservative Party. So you've got these two bits of the population which, if you put them on a political spectrum, are at opposing ends, have for the first time in generations found something that they agree on. And that's making life for the Conservatives here in Labour very difficult as they try to square that circle.
Well, yeah, and also as those two parties, or the base of those two parties, is actually getting more and more polarised.
Yeah, and that's it. We've talked here before, I think, about the country has always been. All countries are polarised, of course. Their societies have different things. You have rich versus poor, liberal versus conservative. If we say global, homeless globalness, as Theresa May put it, against a much more locally based community and family life, left wing against right wing, Tory against Labour. All of a sudden now you've got a new divide, Remain versus Leave. But the people in that don't fall in the same way as the other. It cuts straight through all of those other divisions. So you do have pro-Remain Tories and pro-Leave Tories and pro-Remain poor and pro-Leave poor, etc., etc., cutting all of those different axes. And all of a sudden, I think the challenge for UK politics, and increasingly I think for politics in a lot of the Western developed nations, is there are topics that don't fit neatly into the party structures as we've traditionally known them.
I actually think the Brexit split is a lot more healthy than the other splits which we are seeing in UK society, because actually it is a split on something political rather than something identitarian, which I think is getting more and more prevalent.
Yeah.
Last bit of European comment for you. I do feel a little bit for President Macron, because he's, by this time, his popularity has fell.
Yeah.
And my feeling is he's bided his time for his great European vision for when his great ally Angela Merkel has returned to power with a stonking majority.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened, but he has still proceeded to give us his vision for Europe. Is what he's suggesting possible?
I think broadly it is, and I say that really because essentially the vision he outlined this week is pretty close to what people like Tusk have been talking about for a while. Mm. So, you know, there was I think in the very early podcast we talked about the Five Presidents report from the EU, which laid out three or four different possible future paths for
the EU.
That's
right, yeah.
One of those, of course, was absolutely around much, much tighter integration, concepts of common budgets, common defence forces, integrated common politics. And I think for those of us kind of outside on the looking in and the debating side and the policy side, we've always said the EU post the recession, post the Great Recession 2008, post the Euro crisis 2011, 2012, and again, you know, we talked about people not knowing much about European politics. Don't worry, none of the UK newspapers are telling you that Greece is basically exactly where it was 5 years ago.
It's
Italy is exactly where it was 5 years ago. Nothing has changed in those countries. Spain is looking better and healthier, and it's starting to recover pretty well now, but it's got a long way to go. Portugal, similarly, rebounding nicely a long way. But, you know, the Greek problem is still writ every bit as large.
Why is there no... I mean, there might be political kickback in Greece, but why do we not hear about it in relation to the EU? Because I don't feel that we hear nearly enough about it.
No, I would agree entirely. And this, I think, goes back to, for me, it's probably one of the reasons why so many people in the UK voted Leave. I'm not expressing opinions here on whether that's a good or a bad thing. What I mean is actually the UK's relationship with Europe as a continent has always been slightly odd. That it's next door, it's hugely important. You know, we fought to get in. Three times it took us to get in the European community. We fought, you know, the single market was something that we built, essentially. We asked and we built for. But it's still always been kind of an other.
Mm.
You know, the UK media, the UK people have always described Europe as them. Has always described the EU as them. It's never been an us.
Yeah,
And so European politics has just never really featured on our agenda, and it's one of the things that fascinates me when I'm over there. So I was in Spain earlier this year. You turn on the television news, read the major papers. Not only, of course, are you dominated by that Spanish news, obviously, but you also get lots of stories around Europe, and this is major stuff. So it's not a cat's got stuck up a tree in Berlin. There's major stuff about an agricultural crisis in some of the central bits of Europe. There's major stuff about big political divides in Eastern Europe. So Poland is going through some very difficult political movements at the moment.
Mm.
Possibility of suspending its judges. Is major, major stuff, which just doesn't really cotton on. But what you also see in those Spanish papers, actually, is pages and pages devoted to what's going on in Argentina, what's going on in Mexico, what's going on in essentially the old Spanish colonies. There's a much wider interest in what's going on. Actually, our papers are essentially obsessed with the UK and the US.
I think the Express is still running Princess Diana stories.
Yeah, we don't actually seem to look at all this stuff. Because, I mean, you know, the news story we talked about earlier with Bombardier and the Trudeau, this must be the first time Canada has been on the front page of a UK newspaper in decades. Name me the last major news story you heard about from Canada or New Zealand. It's just not in our psyche.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're a lot more comfortable dealing with the Americans than we are the Europeans. In fact, than anyone else.
Yeah, and if we talk about Europe, actually, what we're mostly talking about is Brussels.
Yeah,
we're not actually talking about
Brussels.
Europe. It's always about the European Union, not about those countries of themselves. So I think historically I would have said this is a peculiarly UK trait. I think it's, you know, America's in the same box. You know, America's, you know, you look at America's world news, you'd be very lucky to get any news outside America at all.
Yeah.
What is it, you know, 60% of Americans don't hold a passport, they've never travelled outside, outside the country. But it's a big, big country.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, it does have different rules than that, but it doesn't look at the world in the same way. I think, you know, since kind of post-war and certainly post sort of 70s, 80s, the UK has increasingly looked to the US and to almost nowhere else.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Right, before we wrap up, I want you to give me a grade for Theresa May's speech and tell me if you think it has helped or hindered, and then we will go home.
I would say 2 out of 10, and
2 out of 10.
Yeah,
scathing.
Just because it didn't say what needed to be said. I think that's the thing. Has it helped? I don't think it's hindered. Actually, whilst it was bad, it hasn't. It's not made anything worse. But it hasn't really moved anything forward. You know, it's detail. We need the detail. And, you know, we're in the negotiation stop as time of recording tomorrow lunchtime. If we haven't got approval, if we haven't got citizens' rights, Northern Ireland border, and the divorce papers signed off by tomorrow lunchtime, we are not moving to trade negotiations in November. It will be January.
Superb. Right, well, thank you as always. We'll be back next week, and we'll be back to our gang. Is there a gang of three? What are we thinking of?
I think we're probably a gang of four.
A gang of four? Was that the Liberal Democrats, the gang of four?
Might have been. There was a quad at the heart of the coalition, of course, the four. But it will be three next week.
We will definitely be a gang of three. Again, you can find me at Jay Beardmore, and Christian
at GMCC_Christian.
Until next week, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's AURA.com/safety.